the U.S. has a problem with accessibility of guns by those who are mentally ill, yes.
Senator Lisa Murkowski addresses mass shootings in her annual address to the state legislature. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaskans weigh in on the Trump administration's offshore drilling proposal.
I was here to voice my frustration that there wasn't a comment drawn from coastal communities. No meetings were held in any coastal communities.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medications prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
In her annual address at the state capitol, Senator Lisa Murkowski spoke passionately about the shooting that killed 17 at a Florida high school last week. She called on Congress to take action. She said both sides of the aisle in Washington need to talk about how to end the violence, and no issue should be off limits for discussion. But as Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports, there was one word she left unsaid.
Murkowski's speech, as usual, covered recent accomplishments in Washington, especially new opportunities for oil development on federal lands and waters. But she said she had to address the latest mass school shooting. Murkowski says the political impasse in Congress has to end, as does the tragedy cycle.
Where we have a tragedy happen, we all express our condolences. We then lock into our political stances, and nothing is done until the next tragedy hits, and then we express our outrage all over again.
She touched on a number of areas Congress can improve, even mentioning the possibility of an app kids could use to report a classmate who seems off kilter.
Help on the mental health side, help with the assessment, help with the training side, address the clear inadequacies that we have within our background check system, and then deal in some of these other areas where we know we have way too many open doors.
She spoke about how to prevent the next mass shooting for nearly 9 minutes without saying the word gun. When a reporter asked her about that at a press conference afterward, she said that wasn't exactly true because she talked about background checks.
You know, background check for what? You have to go through that background check in order to get a gun. I'm using the word gun. I'm okay using that.
One of the loudest calls from the high school students who survived the Florida shooting is to ban the AR-15 and similar semi-automatic rifles of the type that were used in Newtown in San Bernardino at Orlando's Pulse nightclub in Texas in Las Vegas. Murkowski asserted her support for the Second Amendment and said banning a particular weapon isn't the answer.
A weapon can be a gun. A weapon can be a vehicle. A weapon can be a chemical. So I don't want us to focus on just the weapon.
Asked whether America has a problem with the accessibility of guns, Murkowski narrowed her response.
I think the U.S. has a problem with accessibility of guns by those who are mentally ill, yes.
Mental health advocates emphasize that most people with mental illnesses are nonviolent, and a 2015 study found people with diagnosed mental illness commit only a small percentage of U.S. gun fatalities. State Representative Adam Wool, a Fairbanks Democrat, said in his office later that he appreciates Murkowski's thoughtful discussion. He says he also likes Murkowski's focus on combating mental illness, though Wool doubts that's the root cause of America's mass shooting problem.
There's mental health issues everywhere, but in this country, it turns into mass gun violence, and I think that's an important distinction.
Alaska's U.S. senators address the state legislature every year. Senator Dan Sullivan's speech is scheduled for Monday. With help in Juneau from KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaskans gathered in Anchorage last night to weigh in on the Trump administration's proposal to open almost all Alaska waters to oil and gas development. The Wednesday night meeting was the only opportunity for Alaskans to comment on the draft proposal in person. But as Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk reports, it wasn't the meeting some participants had hoped for.
When it came to the 100 or so Alaskans who showed up to the meeting, there were no surprises. Outside, a group of protesters gathered, waving signs and chanting about the potential environmental consequences of offshore drilling. Inside the conference center, a pro-industry group held their own mini-rally. The speakers extolled the economic promise of oil development off Alaska's shorelines.
The Outer Continental Shelf has the opportunity to run our economy for another 100 years, to keep our pipeline full.
But once you got into the meeting itself, the Federal Bureau of Ocean Energy Management took over the choreography. Citizens were greeted by a video projected on a large screen, offering a cheery explanation of the Trump administration's sweeping offshore drilling proposal.
Based on comments received from citizens, elected officials, tribes, and others, as well as BOEM's analysis, the secretary made his decision to consider the areas shown on this map for potential oil and gas leasing.
A map of Alaska flashed across the screen, surrounded by potential areas for oil and gas development. Everywhere from the Arctic Ocean to the Gulf of Alaska is under consideration for offshore drilling. Only the Bristol Bay region is off the table.
This video plays on a loop, so we encourage people to come in here and watch it. And you might want to consider doing it as well. It's pretty interesting.
That's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management spokesperson John Callahan, giving me a quick tour of the setup. He guides me into the neighboring room.
So these are the tables I was talking about earlier. This is NEPA analysis and the process.
Friendly federal employees stood behind the tables, ready to explain the complex bureaucratic process the government uses to decide where drilling should and shouldn't be allowed. By now, you might be wondering, at what point in this process did Alaskans get to speak out?
Here are the stations where people input their comments.
And there's three laptops and...
Actually five, yeah.
At this meeting, there was no podium, so I couldn't actually hear what Alaskans were telling the Trump administration about its offshore drilling proposal. I was told I could log into the website, regulations.gov, and read what people typed in. Or I was free to chase random Alaskans down and ask them what they wrote, which is what I did. And a lot of what I heard in the hallway were complaints about the meeting itself. Here's Noah Sunflower with the Alaska Marine Conservation Council.
I was here to voice my frustration that there wasn't a comment drawn from coastal communities. No meetings were held in any coastal communities.
Anchorage is hundreds of miles away from parts of Alaska that could be directly affected by the draft offshore drilling proposal. Fishing ports like Dutch Harbor or North Slope villages like Kektovik. This time around, there were no meetings in those places. Sunflower didn't think that was fair. Neither did Adrian Titus, who is originally from Unalakleet, but now lives in Fairbanks.
Of course, there's only one meeting, and it'd be in the metropolis of Anchorage.
That's part of why Titus, who is with the activist group Native Movement, helped organize the protest that was held outside. I asked Jim Kendall, who's in charge of the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management's Alaska branch, why there was only one meeting held in Anchorage.
We needed to keep on schedule, and we don't have unlimited resources, and we are taking a very national perspective in terms of this national program.
Kendall argued it made sense to hold the meeting in Anchorage because it's centrally located. He added that this isn't the end of the process. When Interior releases the next stage of its proposal, Alaskans can weigh in again. And at that stage, Kendall says it's likely meetings will be held in communities near where offshore drilling is proposed. This particular exercise in American democracy will end in 2019, when the Trump administration is expected to make a final decision on its offshore drilling plan. That means the first offshore oil lease sale in Alaska's Arctic could happen as soon as next year. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, after her Olympic gold win, Keegan Randall now serves an important role with the Olympics.
The ability to go out and inspire kids now to dream big and to have that confidence like our role models did for us, I think that's what's really kept us motivated all these years.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you love a good mystery, Thursday nights on Alaska Public Media TV is the place for you. Join us every week as we search for clues, put the pieces together, and figure out who done it. Mystery Thursdays only on Alaska Public Media TV.
Today is the 38th day of the scheduled 90-day legislative session. The House and Senate Finance Subcommittees have been making their way through the state budget. We decided it was a good time to touch base with our reporter in the Capitol, Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Lori.
So tell us, where do things stand at this point in the session?
Like you were saying, the House Finance Subcommittees have been finishing their work. They've been meeting with officials from the Walker administration over the past month, and now they've been finalizing the budgets.
So how does the budget look?
For the share of the budget that the legislature directly controls, the House version looks to be pretty similar to the $4.5 billion that Governor Bill Walker proposed. There are some tweaks, including an additional $19 million for the University of Alaska. These budgets are headed to the entire House Finance Committee and then onto the House floor in the next week or two. Members of the Republican House minority would like to see cuts. They've been proposing cuts in committee, but the majority is not adopting many of them. Republicans have different views on how the budget process has been this year. The leader of the caucus, Anchorage Republican Sharice Millett, says the majority are handling minority amendments better than they were last year. But Eagle River Representative Laura Reinbold says she's not pleased with the process.
Andrew, you've been talking about the House. What's happening in the Senate? What's going on there?
The Senate Finance Committee also has been meeting, and cuts are more likely to be occurring on the Senate side. We shouldn't expect to see cuts on the scale that the Senate talked about last year when they were talking about $750 million being cut over 3 years. This year, the Senate majority says they'd like to see cuts, but they are not talking about cuts on the scale of what they said last year.
Well, if there aren't going to be those deep cuts, does that mean that the legislature is likely able to get out of Juneau in the scheduled 90 days?
Maybe, or maybe not. Even if they reach an agreement on how much to spend, the question of where the money is going to come from is not answered yet. There's probably no option but to draw from permanent fund earnings for a purpose other than dividends for the first time in Alaska's history. But how much to draw from the earnings, and maybe more important than that, whether the draw will be the result of a fiscal plan, is very much still to be determined. That issue could push the session beyond the 90 days set by state law, and it may be a challenge to get done in the 121-day session set by the Alaska State Constitution. I'm aiming to report more on this debate tomorrow.
All right, well, that's good. We'll look forward to hearing more about that and understanding it more. But Andrew, beyond the legislative work, what else is happening in the Capitol in Juneau?
I wanted to get back to something that happened here last week that I didn't get a chance to report on, which is the House Finance Committee room was renamed for former House and Senate member Al Adams, who represented North Slope and Northwest Arctic boroughs for 20 years. It was a chance for lawmakers and state officials to recall a member and a time when people worked across party lines. Here's former Representative Reggie Jewell talking about something Adams told a crowd in Kivalina who were unhappy with Republican lawmakers who accompanied the Democrat Adams on a trip there.
He said, "It's true. We don't always get along. But at the end of the day, we'll eat and maybe drink a beer. We're friends, even though we might be political opposites." And that gymnasium in community in Kivalina changed. Just like that.
While Adams died 6 years ago, Adams' family and lawmakers who knew him said they felt his continuing presence in the state and that he would live on in the Capitol.
Sounds like it was a very nice honoring. Thanks so much for bringing that into the conversation today, Andrew.
You're welcome, Laurie. Thank you.
That was Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reporting from Juneau. Senate Republicans have confirmed the appointment of Mike Schauer to fill a vacancy in District E. Schauer is a 20-year veteran of the United States Air Force and retired at the rank of lieutenant colonel. Senate President Pete Kelly praised Schauer's military service, saying, quote, Alaska is home to more military veterans per capita than any other state in the union, and we hope Mr. Schauer brings that culture of service to the legislature as he works on behalf of the people of District E. End quote. Kelly and his colleagues sent a letter to Governor Bill Walker today announcing the confirmation, which was signed by all 13 Senate Republicans. And Governor Walker has appointed Tiffany Zolkowski to serve as House District 38's new state representative. The governor's office announced his decision in a press release this morning, quote, the governor saying, I am proud and humbled to forward someone with such a compelling background and strong voice to the House Democrats for consideration. He added that if or when Zolkowski is confirmed, he is confident she will serve the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta well. In a written statement this morning, Zolkowski wrote that she is, quote, honored and excited by the governor's announcement. Zolkowski grew up in Bethel and has worked in local politics and communications for years. In her early 20s, Zolkowski was elected to Bethel City Council and a year later appointed mayor. At age 24, she was the youngest mayor in Bethel's history. It's been a whirlwind few days for Keegan Randall. The Anchorage skier made Olympic history yesterday, winning gold and the first medal ever for the women's U.S. cross-country ski team. And today, Randall was elected to the International Olympic Committee Athletes Commission. Alaska Public Media's Emily Russell reports.
Keegan Randall has dominated cross-country skiing for decades. She's skied in 5 Winter Olympics and competed in 9 World Championships, winning plenty of high honors along the way. And this week, Randall checked off one final box, Olympic gold medalist. She and her teammate Jesse Diggins edged out Sweden by the slimmest of margins, less than 2/10 of a second in the team sprint in Pyeongchang. At a press conference after the race, Randall talked about her home state and how it helped mold her into an elite athlete.
Growing up as a kid in Alaska, you know, we don't have the professional sports teams, so you grow up idolizing the Olympic athletes from our state. And I had incredible role models both in my family, an aunt and uncle that were Olympians, and also Nina Kempel, who was the top woman in the U.S. that really took me under her wing at my first Olympics.
Her first Olympics were back in 2002 in Salt Lake City. Randall finished 44th in the sprint. She credits the team and coaches at Alaska Pacific University for upping her game and getting her on the medal podium for the first time at the Olympics. When she's not training, Randall spends time helping others get into the sport of cross-country skiing. She pointed out to reporters on Wednesday that not everybody has access to slick bobsleds or steep downhill ski jumps.
But everybody can cross-country ski, and I think I hope we've awakened an interest, and it's finally fun to get our sport a good spotlight like that, and the ability to go out and inspire kids now to dream big and to have that confidence like our role models did for us. I think that's what's really kept us motivated all these years.
Shortly after the press conference, Randall got news she'd been elected to the International Olympic Committee Athletes Commission. The 20 commissioners act as a link between athletes and the IOC. Randall begins her 8-year term on the Athlete Commission on February 26th. In Anchorage, I'm Emily Russell.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
The president signed a bill this month that directs recovery funds to fisheries disasters on the West Coast, including in Alaska. But it's still unclear how the limited funds will be distributed. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche looked into the next steps.
In a letter to the U.S. Senate in January, senators wrote that they saw a $150 million need in Alaska following the 2016 pink salmon season disaster in the Gulf. They also identified a $140 million need for the fisheries disasters in California and a $117 million need for those in Washington state. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski was among those to sign the letter and said the Bipartisan Budget Act grants the three states a lot less than the requested amount.
There's only $200 million that has been identified for all nine of these disasters. So there's going to have to be a level of prioritization. There's going to have to be just some critical evaluation of what the criteria will be.
So far, that process is murky. Barbara Blake, a fisheries staffer and senior advisor to the governor and lieutenant governor, says the state congressional delegation will work with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to determine where the funds will be placed. While eight other fisheries disasters are vying for the funds, Blake says the governor's office is hopeful about Alaska's claim.
As we were told, our data is very good in comparison to others who didn't have as comprehensive data when they submitted their numbers in relation to their disaster declarations.
Kodiak is one of the areas in the state waiting for funds. Representative Louise Stutes says they had hoped for more money, but at least it's something.
No matter how little or how much, every bit makes a difference to a fisherman.
So far, state leaders are not sure about a timeline for the distribution of the funds. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
Last year, 3,000 Alaskans received help with rent and utilities from government sources. That number only shows a fraction of the need. Countless others turn to friends, family, domestic violence shelters, and the faith community. This winter, Anchorage resident Dion Nguyen was one of them. After an unexpected illness prevented him from working, he sought help. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has been following his story for the Solutions Desk.
Dion Nguyen ushers two guests into his home from his wheelchair, inviting them into the kitchen. They're both volunteers with the St. Vincent de Paul Society, a Catholic organization that helps people with rental assistance.
I'll be asking some questions, and it's for our records. We have to, I'm not trying to be too personal, let me put it that way.
Yes, ma'am.
Rachel Ireton begins to ask Dion about his situation. How much income does he have? How much is his rent? Dion's straightforward with the answers and tries to explain how he got into this situation. His leg got infected, the doctor amputated his toe, he can't work. He tells Rachel he's unhappy about it.
I really just want to get back to work so I can pay my own bills, and I would appreciate if you or the church would give me this assistance this time. I work, so I just got in a bad situation.
When Dion realized he would be out of work, a social worker helped him apply for public assistance, like food stamps and Medicaid. But Dion wasn't eligible for other government help to pay his rent. Someone told him to turn to a different source, the faith communities.
We are limited in how much we can help you with.
Yes, ma'am.
And we cannot make any promises.
Yes, ma'am.
The St. Vincent de Paul Society is funded through donations. Catholic congregations in Anchorage pass the plate during church services to collect money for them a few times a year. Other individuals donate too. If a person of any faith needs short-term financial assistance with rent or utilities, they call the organization's cell phone. One of the group's 20 volunteers answers, learns more about the situation, and schedules a home visit. Two volunteers go to each person's home for a face-to-face interview. That's why Rachel was at Dion's house. St. Vincent de Paul Society President Richard Whitney says the home visit is about more than collecting information.
It puts a very real face on the need. So often in our society, when we think about the poor, we think about it as a problem. And too often that removes the humanity from the situation. It removes the face of the person. And for the Vincentian, that face is going to be the face of the person, but that's also for us, that's going to be Christ.
Richard explains that for the volunteers in his small Catholic organization, helping people in need is a path for spiritual growth. Like the federal rental assistance programs, the group will only help a person if the situation is sustainable. If one-time help will get them over a speed bump, they'll send a check to the landlord or the utility, or offer gift cards for food or gas. But if the person will be in perpetual need, then they won't offer their limited resources. The number of requests they receive varies by season. Winter is the busiest. And they don't have the financial or human capacity to help everyone.
We might get 30 calls a week, and we can only do 5 because we're a volunteer organization. So we might have to schedule someone the next week.
Once the group helps someone, they don't ask for anything in return. The person doesn't need to pay them back. But if they do offer, Richard puts in another request instead.
Sounds kind of cheesy, but I like to say, will you pray for us? You know, that's the main thing, and it's totally free. And for us, I think that's probably the most valuable thing that someone could actually give back to us. Just pray for us and pray for our work and pray for the other people in need.
Back at Dion's house, Rachel finishes up the interview.
Okay, is there anything else that you wanted to tell us?
No, I just, you know, really appreciate you giving me your time. If you are able to assist me, I would appreciate it. I would pay it back. You know, I would donate the money back like I told Gil. When I get on back on my feet, I would donate it back to you all. I don't have no problem doing that. Yeah.
We don't ask that. That does happen.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a requirement.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so would you like to say a prayer?
Yeah.
Dion's not Catholic, but he is Christian, and he thinks it's God's will that's helping him through. Together, they prayed. After the interview, Rachel spoke with Dion's landlord and learned she was willing to work with Dion and help him through the rough spell. In the end, the organization gave $500. The amount helped Dion pay his rent for that month. But what about his future? Follow his story on alaskapublic.org/solutions. From the Solutions Desk, I'm Anna Hillman.
Finally tonight, a correction. A story last evening about a bill to legalize industrial hemp production incorrectly identified the district that State Senator Shelley Hughes represents. Senator Hughes' District F covers the greater Palmer area south to Chugiak. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, you can find them at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Harbaugh and Hillman and Emily Russell in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Teresa Katsourilis in Bethel, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, and Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Never miss another episode of your favorite PBS primetime programs thanks to Afternoon Tea on Alaska Public Media TV. Every weekday, you can catch up on the drama of Masterpiece. Be amazed by our universe with Nature and Nova. Search for garage treasures on Antiques Roadshow and solve mysteries alongside our favorite detectives. Watch Afternoon Tea weekdays from 3 to 5 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.